I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
19 hours. That's how much online video people are watching on average in a week. And the demand for video is only growing. If you're a content creator, you know the struggle of picking between quality and quantity to grow your channel, especially if you're on a tight budget. But who says you can't have both? With Storyblocks, you get all the stock content you need to create amazing videos fast. While most stock libraries have expensive pay-per-clip pricing, Storyblocks gives you unlimited downloads for one set price. Download anything from a library of millions of 4K and HD footage clips, After Effects templates, music, sound effects, images, and more. Everything is covered by our industry-leading licensing that lets you share your videos anywhere, anytime. Plans start at just $15 a month. Find all the stock you need and create faster than ever so you can tell your story your way. Visit storyblocks.com/redcircle to learn more.
We made USAA insurance for veterans like James. When he found out how much USAA was helping members save, he said,
it's time to switch.
We'll help you find the right coverage at the right price. USAA. What you're made of, we're made for. Restrictions apply.
Science proves quality sleep is vital to your mental, emotional, and physical health. The Sleep Number 360 smart bed senses your movements and automatically adjusts to help keep you both effortlessly comfortable. And it's temperature balancing, so you stay cool. So you're at your best for yourself and those you care about most. Life-changing sleep, only from Sleep Number. It's our Black Friday sale. Save 50% on the Sleep Number 360 limited edition smart bed, plus free home delivery on all smart beds when you add a base. And Cyber Monday. To learn more, go to sleepnumber.com.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
And in the second part of this interview with Billy Ray Martin, we go back to London, where Billy had moved to from Berlin, and where her career really started.
And you went to these first clubs that were really opening up, weren't they? There was, I think it was the Paul Oakenfold Night at Heaven, that actually started in the club in Hungerford Lane. Do you remember the club behind Heaven, the little one? There was actually, Heaven was two clubs. It was the massive.
I do. The little one I went to later for some techno and stuff. I don't, that little place. It was great.
It started there and then it grew into the bigger club. I mean, almost immediately, because it was one of those things. So you'd been there, hadn't you? You'd actually experienced that. What was it like? Because I went to Shoom with Kim Mazelle when that opened.
Yes, I went there.
And that was just genius.
I met Mark Moore there and said to him, I want to sing in your group. And he said, fine. That was that.
So were you aware of who was doing what? Were you actually very aware
of who,
you know, I mean, so when you went out, you could sort of say, ah, look, there's so-and-so, and make a beeline in a way.
No, not at all, because that didn't happen in the beginning. In the beginning, I heard there's this new music, this new kind of music, which nobody knows yet, but there's a few people that go to heaven on I don't know if it was a Wednesday or whatever it was, you know, Thursday, I have no idea. And there are some strange dances that people do, and you know, and it's something to check out. So I just went, and there were literally 20 people on the dance floor in the big room at Heaven, and they were doing sort of robotic dances, and they played acid house, and there were some people standing around the dance floor with their arms folded in front of them, and they were very skeptical, you know. And there were some hip-hop guys and all kinds of people standing there going, nah, you know, and what the fuck is this, you know. And I loved it immediately, went back next week. So now you didn't have 20 people on the dance floor, but you had all the hip-hop guys and all the other guys also on the dance. So this grew like wildfire. 3 weeks later, you had 400-500 people. It really was that amazing, you know. And then there was no more, you know, the hip-hop guys don't like it and the Rare Groove guys don't like it. They were all there, you know. So,
I mean, the Shoom, when I was at Shoom, there was this massive energy to the club. I mean, it was absolutely incredible. There was, you know, and I really love that. But tell me about this meeting with Mark Moore, because you must have gone up to him and he wouldn't have known who you are. So no, how did he react?
No, because I hadn't sung on anything yet in England. But I'd read an interview in the NME of where Mark was saying that anyone who's crazy enough can sing in S Express. And of course I loved Theme from S Express, you know. There was a mystery to the video too. I thought, wow, there are all these people, you know, in the video, and they're great. And so I saw Mark and then plucked up all my courage and went up to him and I said, hi, I'm a singer. And he said, oh, really? And I said, you know, and I saw in the NME that, you know, I could sing in your group. And he said, give me your phone number. And, you know, if something occurs, I'll give you a call. And he did. Took a little while. And he called and said, could you come to the studio tomorrow to sing a couple of things?
Can you remember his reaction to the first time you sang?
Yeah, I think they were very happy. Yeah.
Songs with Mark Moore and that experience with Mark Moore, what do you feel that gave you? Because suddenly it feels like when I read about that period, or I've heard interviews with you about that period, it sounds like you suddenly found a little community to be in.
Yeah, because, you know, we were, Hey Music Lover was a big hit and we were booked to play a lot of big festivals and things, you know. And I was only the guest singer, so I could be pretty crazy, you know, and just sort of tag along, which I did. But I mean, I just loved all the people. They were nuts. They were all insane, you know, in a very good way. And Mark was sort of, you know, the mastermind behind it all. He just watched all the madness and found it funny, you know. It's a bit sort of that Andy Warhol thing, you know, you watch the madness and you smile and you to yourself, you know. And we were booked a lot in Germany, playing crazy festivals, and Italy. And so, yeah, I just had fun, you know. I don't know if I necessarily fitted in with this group, but it was a massive experience, you know, really amazing. And I remember we did this thing in Italy, which I would love to get there's no video of it that we can get hold of. We played in this for a television station in Napoli, in Naples. And I couldn't be bothered to mime to my part. So first of all, I was wearing like a slightly see-through top, and everyone in the group thought it was hilarious because it wasn't really done, but to me it was like normal, you know, just be a bit punk rock, and they were like giggling, and you know, so there was that. And then when my part came up, I want to take you higher, I just stood there, you know, looking bored. Mark thought it was hilarious. We were shown the footage, you know, and Mark saw me not miming, and then anybody else would have kicked me out of the group, you know. And he just thought it was hilarious. So it was really, you could just be yourself in S Express.
Were you also writing songs at that stage and actually sort of developing your own creativity in the background, as it were?
I'd already written a lot of songs in Berlin with the Soul, with Billy and the Deep, and also another group. But in London, yeah, on Pimps, Pushers and Prostitutes, I wrote the Who's Gonna Pick Me Up, which later became that song and that song and that song. So yeah, I would always bring along some bits that I'd written. And at that time I had already written Talking With Myself too, which later became the Electribe song.
So were these songs, okay, I know you wrote some in Berlin on the way, but also in London, were these songs that started to get really influenced by your own experiences, your own relationships, your own feelings and whatever?
Yeah, but that had always been the case, you know, always. So I guess I just developed a little bit, you know, as a writer, probably in earnest, you know. Yeah.
I mean, what I love about your story is that there are immense moments of highs, mm-hmm. and there are, you know, the rejection and immense moments of lows.
Yeah.
There are the comebacks, there are the changes. It's sort of, it's a film in itself, but a very long film of different dynamics. And one of them is, you know, it includes the cliche of the advert. I mean, it's sort of the cliche in the music business, isn't it? Someone puts an advert in a newspaper, you know, Elton John looking for a, you know, a writer, and along comes Bernie Taupin. And
yes,
it's similarly, but what I love about your advert was the terminology, what you wrote. Can you remember what you wrote?
Yeah. Soul Rebel seeks musicians, genius only.
Now, if I had seen that advert, and I was a musician, and I have no talent in this department, but I was a musician, and I saw that genius only, that would scare the shit out of me.
Yeah, I don't know. I just wanted to make sure I don't get, because, you know, there are always a lot of so-called songwriters around, but they just want to have a hit record and write for commercials and so, you know, and I just didn't want them to even come along. You know? Do you know someone who replied to that ad? And he won't remember this. Glenn Matlock.
No.
From the Pistols.
Oh, wow.
Who at the time was obviously no longer in the Pistols, you know. And he left a message. He left a message on my answering machine. He would not remember me probably, or that incident. But my answering machine had the Pistols song EMI on my answering machine. So when you called me, it would play a Pistols song. And then there was a message when I got home saying, I wrote that. So I called him back and we talked, but I don't know why, but we never met. You know, I think he said, you know, I'm forming a band or I'm doing something. And somehow, for some reason, I hooked up with the other guys instead. So
but when that is an amazing story. And maybe, you know, the idea of you and Glenn Matlock is also phenomenal. Did you meet the geniuses, and did you think they were geniuses when you met them?
No, because they looked like an East German rock band when I met them. They would hate me for saying that. No, because they were just starting to dabble in the same kind of music, the acid house and the house and the dance music that I was interested in. But when they came, they didn't really make that clear, you know. They just sort of said, well, we're in this band and, you know, we don't like our singer and we're looking for someone. And I said, nah. So they kept calling me. Brian kept calling me saying, yeah, but we have a studio in Birmingham, you know, and you can bring your songs. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm coming, you know. So, and I basically walked in with three demos. And when Brian heard the Talking With Myself demo, which was of course completely different from what it later became, he said, you know, Billy, I think that's the song that we should do. And I said, okay. So that's what we did. And so I think I did find my geniuses. I really feel, especially, you know, now listening to the new in inverted commas album that's out, I just can't overstate how brilliant they are. And at the time, you know, sometimes when you're making music in a group, you don't even realize it.
What was the dynamic between you at first? Were you very much in control in the studio, or were they, or was it really a sort of thing of the contribution came from every angle? Because sometimes there is a dynamic, and I can tell that you are quite a strong character, even from the interview. you know, well, and that's probably would... come through your grandmother.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, I would bring the records, you know, I would bring Julian Jonas, Jealousies and Lies. And I said, that's the production, you know, and I would bring Persuasion and, you know, I would bring Soul Records, which they already knew, they already loved all that music. And, you know, but then of course, so they also were already playing around with stuff. And so it came together. And I think their influence can't be overstated, you know. And even though I was always moaning about this and that element of the production or, you know, it was very much everybody brought their influence in. And that I can't overstate how much you can hear that on this new album. Because when I listened to Joe was the drum guy, but also doing the hooks, you know, all those beautiful Kraftwerk-y hooks and stuff. I mean, wow, you know, he just came up with that. And that was suddenly just there for me to sing over, you know. And so I could go on and on about all of them bringing something that they already had, but that they had not been able to explore fully, you know. So I think we gave to each other, you know. In terms of a personal dynamic, it's difficult, you know, if you ever try to join four Brummies, you know, I mean, they're their own breed, and they were already a gang. So I was very much the outsider, you know, and we became closer as time went on, you know, but there were also frictions and pressures and, you know, it all went to pot at some point, you know. So, but I certainly
success, felt, you know, you did have success initially, and yeah. But you stayed in London, didn't you? And they were in Birmingham. Yeah. During this period, and you went up there and recorded, and then right. The album came out. But you had success. How did that success feel? And what was your vision of that success? Where did you think that was now going to go?
It's so funny because I never thought of it. It was almost like I'd come from Berlin. I went through some real poverty in London, and suddenly we weren't poor anymore. It was actually the same for the guys, you know. We were all piss poor before that, and suddenly we had a bit of money. But in terms of the success, I never thought about it. I just went, yeah, well, that's what I was trying to say all along in my songs, you know. And suddenly everyone's writing, here's this great new soul singer. And they were interviewing me with questions that reflected that. And I was like, yeah, of course, yeah, you know? So, but I wasn't big headed about it. I was just, yeah, well, that's my story. And finally I can tell it, you know? So I wasn't even stopping for a minute to think about it. I never thought about it. I just, you know, cause I was, the concepts for videos and clothing and styling, that all came from me as well. So I was busy.
Science proves quality sleep is vital to your mental, emotional, and physical health. The Sleep Number 360 smart bed senses your movements and automatically adjusts to help keep you both effortlessly comfortable. And it's temperature balancing, so you stay cool. So you're at your best for yourself and those you care about most. Life-changing sleep, only from Sleep Number. It's our Black Friday sale. Save 50% on the Sleep Number 360 limited edition smart bed, plus free home delivery on all smart beds when you add a base. And Cyber Monday. To learn more, go to sleepnumber.com.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
You talked earlier about sort of self-esteem and a lack of self-esteem. This really suggests that there wasn't a lack of self-esteem by that stage.
No, there was. I just didn't stop. Yeah, I just didn't stop to reflect on anything.
So what was the lack of self-esteem at that stage when you're successful, when you are getting, you know, I mean, you got critically great attention when music journalists start liking your stuff. Mm-hmm. I think for artists, it, you know, it means a huge amount. It means a huge amount for the audience, but the critical side of the audience loving it as well is, you know, is another sort of positive. So I just wonder what that self-esteem was like and that feeling.
I was too busy trying to be myself, not being myself, you know, I was just trying so hard. I was too busy. I never noticed, you know, I'm on top of the pops shimmying away. When I look at it now, those performances, they were strange, but they were also quite good, you know, because I was taking dance lessons from one of the best dancers ever, Suki Miles, you know, because, and she taught me all that stuff, you know, and I just wanted to be the best I could be, you know, final, you know what I mean? And I would always like try and add something else to it. I was never satisfied. You know, we took Suki on tour with us. I wanted her on stage next to me. You know, I wanted to do like a dancing together. I just didn't want to be just by myself there, you know, so I was always just trying to add the next thing, to try and be myself and figure out what else can I do to make this work, you know.
What did the Depeche Mode gig do to your, you know, to supporting Depeche Mode? What did that do to your confidence? Because it does sound horrendous.
Yeah, it was. I mean, like somebody said I should do an 8-part Netflix series about my whole experience in the music industry, because I haven't really, it's never been written down, or, you know, I'm not about to write a book anytime soon. In those days, Depeche Mode fans were sort of really hardcore, you know, and they would just not want any support group on stage. It didn't matter who you were. So we were bottled off stage every night, you know, and we had to stand there and take it and face it. Sometimes I didn't want to go out. Sometimes I didn't go out because I was that distraught by it all, you know. I didn't understand it at first. I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to do this for 2 months, you know. And the band Depeche Mode, they were feeling sorry for us, you know. And they said, yeah, they do that to all of the groups, you know. And I think the band started breaking up because of it, because we were just quite unhappy, you know.
Well, the pressures must have been immense. You know, if you go out on stage and you're having, you know, missiles of certain sorts thrown at you. One thing, you know, that you had tomatoes thrown at you, and I just thought, like, what? How do people get hold of tomatoes at a gig?
They bring them in plastic bags in Paris. It's in Paris. It's a fucking sport. And apparently the Beatles didn't go back for 14 years after they played in Paris once earlier in their career. Because they bring plastic bags. I don't know if they still do it now, those bastards. They bring plastic bags with coins, shoes, tomatoes, vegetables, just to fucking throw them at you. And there were all these things where now I can laugh about it and the group could laugh about it. At the time, nobody laughed about it. There was this one thing where we were playing a song and the lights would always go down in that particular moment. And the song, because there were three nights in Paris in this big stadium. And so the lights went down, you know, because we were already being, you know, bottled off stage and stuff. And we were standing there and the lights went down and I felt this drizzle. And I thought, that's interesting, like a rain effect coming from, you know, somewhere. And when the lights went back up, I sort of turned around and Les on his bass keyboard, he was standing there covered in tomatoes. And one of the tomatoes had switched the keyboard off. And we were all looking at him like, oh my God. And it was so funny, but it wasn't at that time, you know what I mean? And then I remember going after the show and I turned around to the band and I said, after the song, we're off stage, we're going. We're not, you know, so we went off stage. Then we went down to the canteen to eat with Depeche Mode there. And the caterers, they said, would you like some tomatoes with your with your meal? You know, so they were taking a mick out of us, you know, but at that time, we were not smiling, I can tell you, you know.
No, I can imagine that. I mean, it's funny to hear a story like that. You know, it's definitely funny to hear a story like that. But to be on the receiving end, night after night, and to have that humiliation, it's something that grows within you and is very destructive. How do you think that played into, you had the, you know, you had the manager, Tom Watkins, who was also a quite destructive character.
Right.
And he was trying to split up the band, as I understand, which is sort of a classic thing that, you know, some managers do. And I never know where it really comes from. Did he have his reason? Did he have a particular reason? Financial? He wanted someone solo? No. He wanted this?
I mean, to be honest, he tried. He did it to Bros, and the he tried to sack Chris Lowe from the Pet Shop Boys. I mean, you know, but a lot of people in his office, his staff, and also his co-manager, they would take me aside and they would say he does that to all the women. So go figure, you know.
Yeah. That's terrible. And of course, you know, you have this horrendous humiliation with Depeche Mode, you know, you have the problems with Tom Watkins, then you don't have a hit with Inside Out, and then you have the humiliation with the second album in terms of the record company. Can you tell me about that moment that it was rejected and what that did to you?
I think we'd already been arguing as a band between us, you know, so there wasn't a lot of there weren't a lot of good feelings left for many reasons after the tour, you know. And we were trying to, I remember we were musically unsure of ourselves, which listening back to the album now, it's crazy. We had, you know, we could have, I think we knew there was some stuff, but I don't think we were sure that we had an album, you know. And we were also sort of put in the studio with another producer to help us out, and you know, all that big record company stuff that happens to groups, you know. And then I don't think we were very sure, and we did some other demos as well, which I'm not gonna put out there, because we were just sort of, because I would come in with drum and bass, you know, my latest discovery, you know, let's do some of that. And I remember the guys saying, yeah, okay, but I don't know if our demos are good enough. And, you know, so, and I think, so the final straw is then, you know, we deliver this album. And I mean, we did put across that there are a couple of mixes that might need looking at again, you know, but here it is, you know, here's. And then we were told it's a pile of shit.
What, literally those words?
Well, our A&R guy, someone put it to us, at the time we'd gotten rid of Tom Watkins, so I can't remember who actually told us that we were being dropped from the label. And we were told that the managing director had said, what's with this soul shit?
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So we then were without a deal. We tried to get signed and didn't get signed right away. And I think it was different times then, because you didn't have the digital world out there where bands can just go, fuck it, we can release this, you know. I mean, you could form a label, but you'd have to be a very strong unit to do that. And, you know, because it was all about physical, you know, vinyl pressings, you know, and cassettes and, you know, whatever people did at the time. So I don't think that culture was out there yet of being totally self-sufficient. So I think we just broke up instead, you know.
Yeah. I mean, rejection is a very hard thing to deal with. It's hard when you're not successful, but when you've been successful and then you get rejected, it's a bit of a double whammy. So how did that make you feel inside? And what was your reaction to it? Did you sort of hide away at first?
I went to Warner Chapel and they had a demo studio, a very good one, actually. And I said, look, I don't really know what to do, but, you know, we broke up. I told them the band had broken up. And I said, well, let me do some demos, you know, in the studio. So I did some demos, but I remember having absolutely no money. And so that was the hardest, actually, to be really, like, without really worrying about having a roof over your head, you know. So I just did demos for quite a long time.
I mean, I know that financial problem, because if you've, you know, I mean, after I my career sort of died at one point, I had, you know, before that I had a lot of money and I lost everything. I lost my house because, you know, you live on a certain amount of debt sometimes as well. And when the carpet's pulled away, then there's really something, it's about existence and it's about that moment of existence. And that is crushing for your creativity for a while. Yeah. Was it for you?
No, because I just did demos and songwriting. And so the creativity is just, I don't think I had any support network. I think that was the problem about what to do with it. You know, I had no manager, no band, no co-musicians. You know, I would just sort of work with the odd person here and there. And so I think that was the problem more than anything, that I had no infrastructure in which to operate and have my voice maybe put out there again. That didn't happen for 2 years. And it only happened when, because I was so fed up about, because I had at that, so to about, I would say a year and a bit after the band got dropped, I'd written Your Loving Arms, you know.
Did you write that with David Harrow?
Yeah, he did a bit of a techno-y little backing track, which I still have the cassette of, actually. And I wrote a song on top, you know. So I had Your Loving Arms and I had demoed it already, pretty much sounding the way it ended up later sounding. And so I would go around some record companies, you know. I think the publishers probably helped me get a meeting here and there. And it was rejected absolutely everywhere. So I went to New York, was rejected there, you know. And later when it was a big hit in America, they were all like, oh shit, well, you know, we wish we would have signed it. And I'm like, yeah, well, you didn't, you know. So anyway, nobody signed that. And then I remember, and then I had a really terrible manager for a short while, you know, who did absolutely nothing. And one day I was so fed up. And I said to him, you know, don't you think I should do a short showcase gig with my demos? And he just went, well, I don't get involved in that sort of thing. And that was the final straw. And I just called the Jazz Cafe and said, let me do a gig there. You know, and they said, sure. And I was signed literally the next day.
Now, Your Loving Arms was, in essence, for me, I see that as a gay man, as a gay anthem. You know, and it was something, and I have wonderful memories of that song. And there's something so warm and wonderful, and it's almost like an insular experience of love. it's a very beautiful song. And you performed that in Miami at a gay club in Miami. Can you tell me about that?
All the time. I performed it. I think it wasn't a gay club in Miami where I didn't perform. It was, oh my God, it was great. I mean, my first performance was in New York at Junior Vasquez Club. And I can never remember if it was Sound Factory or Twilo at the time. It might've been the last night at Sound Factory, actually. And I had no idea that the song was already so big in the clubs. Like, I had zero idea. And I remember 6 a.m, my performance, you know, and I'm coming out and this wave of screams and love, you know, coming towards me, like literally like this wave. And I hadn't even sung a note. The beat started and people went crazy. So that was the first time I realized, oh my God, this is happening big, which without Junior wouldn't have happened, you know? And I'm forever thankful. And so then I would then later go back and then move. I ended up moving to New York. So then I performed around the United States. And I was always go back to Miami. But at that time, when the song was at its biggest in America, Miami was incredible, you know? I mean, literally just waves of love. And it was as if myself and people had been waiting for that song, you know? Because I remember in one club, I said, well, she'll been waiting long enough to sing that song. And people just screamed when I said that, you know? And so it was just so beautiful, you know, such a moment.
Yeah, no, I mean, as I said, I mean, that song for me is something very special and something of an era. And I was listening to it this morning again, and it brought up all those wonderful feelings and emotions and warmth. And that's why I think it's so beautiful. Now I'm going to jump because I want to talk about the album, obviously. And this album was stuck, in a sense, in your drawer for 30 years.
Yes.
And you didn't think about it. You never thought about what that is. You never listened to it in between.
Never.
So when you finally took it out the drawer and listened to it, how did you see the person that had sung and written those songs all those years ago to the person you are today?
Well, it's funny because when we mastered the recordings, because they were very low level on a DAT, you know, and so it took a lot of restoring and trying different approaches to mastering to actually hear everything. And then so once I could hear everything, I was amazed because actually every word was about what I was going through at that time. And to have had that opportunity at the time, I wasn't even aware of that, you know. Again, something that maybe you don't appreciate when you're that close to it. But, you know, every word, every experience, I mean, it's about my relationship that I was in at the time. And then about some other things too, of course, you know. But yeah, so I was moved. I was moved for the person I was, because I had never been moved before by that. I just did it, you know, you do it, you move on, you know. And the band breaking up wouldn't have, you know, exactly made anyone go back and listen again, you know. I'm sure that the group, the other guys probably didn't, you know. But now that actually made me feel very moved.
What would your older self have said to your younger self at that time to make you feel better?
I don't know. Oh my God.
Because an album is a snapshot of all these feelings, emotions, and thoughts. So it is very much where you were at that time. And as we change and develop in life, we reach another point, which is often more comfortable with ourselves, let's say, and who we are, and not having the same problems and angst and whatever that we had when we were younger. So, you know, is there something very comforting about knowing not only that the music is fantastic and not only what you created there has immense value today, but knowing that you got through a period and got to where you are today?
Well, I think, I'm not sure exactly what I would say, but what strikes me is the realness in the lyrics and the delivery. I was just shouting it out. I mean, the determination with which I'm telling my story. And I think there are two examples. One is the first song, Insatiable Love. She flies into the room just in time for his call and it's time for a change, you know. So that was happening. And I probably did that daily, you know. And, you know, this kind of telling. And then this, she wants to eat the whole world. She tosses and turns like a secret ballet. you know, aching for the thrill of not feeling pain. Wow, I mean, that's heavy shit, you know. And I was, I, how did I even come up with those words? So I would say something about, well, girl, you certainly kept it real, you know. And then the other song, Deadline for My Memories, where I'm like, there's a body on the floor that looks like me. You know, I mean, that's me cry. That's about me crying for the breakup of the relationship, you know, and thinking, that's, is this me that's going through all this trauma, you know?
Has it changed your memories of those times? Because, you know, like we have we have times in our life where we feel, oh, I was pretty unhappy back then. But then later on, you look back and you look upon it differently and you don't see it in the same way. And this album is connected to a lot of difficult experiences, not just musically, but also what was happening with your career and everything back then. It, has this actually sort of given you a warm feeling that of some sort of positive outcome?
Well, it was the beginning of me getting in touch with myself, because the relationship breakup, which went on and on and on, and me acting like some nutcase about it, you know, started the process of who am I? And I bought all these books, all the spiritual and self-help and esoteric stuff, you know, about who am I really? And who's this person that's looking for someone to validate me, you know? And that didn't happen. So what else is there? So I bought all these books and it helped me tremendously. I mean, that was the start of me going, there's something here that I haven't yet done, you know, and that's me. I've never been to me. I've been to paradise. Seriously. So it started the process, which is ongoing today. So without that, I wouldn't have started that, you know.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Creativity is also a compensation for our wounds in life. And we work through our wounds through creativity. I'm a writer today. And for me, that's so important to do. But at the same time, I've done a shitload of therapy as well. Because therapy is something where I've really realized, I believe, who I am and become much more comfortable with who I am. Yet I can still look back at my wounds, let's call them my childhood wounds or whatever, and be able to take things out of that for my creativity, my writing today. So has it changed the way that you deal with creativity because you now have a greater awareness of who you are?
Oh God, I'm really in control now. And I make a lot of mistakes still because, you know, I produce my own records now. You know, I've got 4 albums on the go, which are all hopefully nearing completion soon. And, you know, and I'm really having to pull my thing together, you know, to make them happen. And because being the producer, which, you know, I'm having to learn as I go, you make mistakes and I do, you know, but generally the outcome's been immense. I'm so happy with it, and the mistakes I have to try and deal with them, you know. But so I'm really in control though now.
I mean, the reaction to the album has been universally positive.
The Electra,
Electra, absolutely. I mean, phenomenally positive, and it's almost like you know, this is where the movie script comes. You know, no one would have believed it. Do you know what I mean? That you can dig up an album 30 years ago, and it is so. Feels so current and it, you know, people are so hungry for it and it works so well. Now there must be an immense satisfaction going on within you that this was all worthwhile. Is that how you feel today?
Yeah, I felt when the press articles started coming in, I was more surprised than anyone. I honestly just expected another, you know, there's a couple of people who are going to pick up on it, but nothing will really happen. And then it all sort of started going on. And I was elated. I was really, really, really happy, you know, really, really, I mean, just thrilled, really, and surprised. So,
well, yeah. It's a brilliant album. I mean, I've been through it a few times so the last few days, and I've really, you know, enjoyed the tracks on the album, and each individual track has they're very strong, you know, there's not a weak track, you know, it's all very strong. Okay. and but that really impressed me, that there was so there was so much there, and you hear that and you look back and you think, who was that record company executive?
I know,
to
right?
Say, you know, this is a pile of shit.
Tell me about it. I know it's, and we believed it. That's the bad thing about it. We I think deep in our hearts, we actually thought, oh God, you know, because we were discussing a couple of the mixes and we were saying, oh, that's not very good yet, you know. So rather than someone saying, yeah, that's fine, it's something we can fix, someone said, you know, get lost. Do you know what I mean? So it, yeah, it really broke us.
I'd love to see his face today.
I don't think he cares. I don't think he would remember any of it. You know what I mean? Because, you know, yeah.
Yeah, no, but that is, I mean, I know revenge is silly, but in a way, there is this, there is this little taste of revenge because it's in the air that this mistake, you know, he made such a mistake years ago.
Yeah.
And that mistake has led to something which is really fantastic and perfect for today.
You.
Now, you talked about these new albums, and one of them is inspired by French music. I understand Charles Aznavour, Jacques Brel. And was French music always in your life? Because if I remember my, you know, youth, my mum loved these sort of torch singers, and Charles Aznavour was amongst them.
Of course,
them.
You know. I mean, Charles Aznavour was the French Liza Minnelli, you know, and his songwriting, his words, that what he wrote about was so ahead of its time. And he was singing, you know, the song What Makes a Man, you know, so here's a young straight man singing about what it is to be gay and being persecuted by society. That was not done, you know, that was a no-go, you know, and he had hits with it, you know what I mean, hit records, and I mean, all of that is so powerful, and, but generally, I grew up with, the album's inspired by everything French movies, movie soundtracks of the 1970s, especially a composer, François de Roubaix. That's how that all started. I heard his music, and I thought, holy crap, I mean, really, I'm going to do that. And then it quickly turned into something totally different. But you can hear, you know, that influence. And then it's about some of my favorite films, which are either French or about or set in Paris. And the characters in those films, I mean, I read the film scripts and stuff, you know, and so I always make up stories around what else could have happened, or how did the person in that movie really feel if they're not saying that in the script, you know. So I write songs around those characters. So it's about all that. And then I thought, well, and that would be the opportunity to also sing my favorite Aznavour songs and a couple of Jacques Brel as well.
I mean, my favorite Aznavour song is Yesterday When I Was Young.
I did that one. Yeah.
Oh my God, I just love that song.
And guess who I played it with? The members of the Tindersticks, the group, the Tindersticks. And because I wanted to make it really weird, like a hypnotic movie soundtrack, you know? And I discovered the Tindersticks film soundtracks and other stuff they've done. And I thought, I should just ask those guys. But you don't just go and ask an existing group to come and play. But they came, three of them, and played. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't even believe I'm in the studio with them, you know? And they're very strange. And then, 2 days ago, we recorded a 40-piece string orchestra as well for this. And I couldn't be more thrilled, you know? It's just like, yeah.
And that sounds like it's a really heart project, you know what I mean?
And I mean, Yesterday When I Was Young, he was 25 when he wrote that. It's just crazy what that man did, you know? So
yeah, he was also an amazing film actor.
Yes.
And as well. And I, you know, but Yesterday That When I Was Young, I've always thought, although it's the, you know, the regret and everything,
yeah.
It's the song that I definitely want at my funeral.
Yeah, right?
Even though I don't regret anything in my life, it's still the song that I want there, because I know everyone's going to be in tears. It's going to really cause havoc.
But how brave it was to sing about these feelings that someone has. You know, he was singing about an old man who regrets, you know, everything that he hasn't done. And he was 25 when he wrote that. Or, you know, when he wrote things like What Makes a Man, about, you know, I'm strip teasing in a gay bar, you know. And this was after, I mean, this man was slaughtered by the French press. He said he couldn't sing. He was ugly. He was short. And he shouldn't be in show business, you know. He was booed off stage. He was, the press hunted him down, you know. And this guy just went, fuck you. And then when he did, I think it was La Boheme, he did that performance, you know. And then suddenly applause came. And then he goes and writes about a gay man when you're not supposed to be gay. I mean, this guy, you know, crazy, amazing.
Yeah, but this, I want to end now, because it's finally that when you talk about, you know, in that way with so much emotion about, you know, another singer and their experience and how they have had to deal with the world, I can see where your power came from and where you've had to deal with your experiences along the way that have been, you know, unbelievably fantastic and unbelievably terrible. You know, they've been extremely hard and come out of it in such a positive way with such a positive future. So in the end, I just want to thank you for all the creativity you've put out into the world.
Thank you. Some
of the most amazing music, particularly this album. But I still have to say, because it's my favorite and it has such an appeal to me, Your Loving Arms was something that so touched me back then. And it was such a wonderful feeling, and because as a gay man and this sort of gay anthem of feeling having these arms around me,
yes,
you know what I mean, and protected.
Don't that make was me cry now.
The song was about, so Billy Ray Martin,
God, you're gonna make me cry. Oh my god,
thank you so much,
thank you.
Oh no, I didn't want it to end. Well, that's it for this interview with Billy Ray Martin. I'll see you soon.
Science proves quality sleep is vital to your mental, emotional, and physical health. The Sleep Number 360 smart bed senses your movements and automatically adjusts to help keep you both effortlessly comfortable. And it's temperature balancing, so you stay cool. So you're at your best for yourself and those you care about most. Life-changing sleep, only from Sleep Number. It's our Black Friday sale. Save 50% on the Sleep Number 360 limited edition smart bed, plus free home delivery on all smart beds when you add a base. And Cyber Monday. To learn more, go to sleepnumber.com.